This is Jim Inkster coming today on the show. We'll talk with Tara McGinnis of the Center for Progress Action. She'll discuss gun violence in Louisiana as lawmakers prepare to weigh the merits of gun rights legislation. There was a big rally at the Capitol yesterday from Defend Louisiana. Also on the show, LSU's Alumnus of the Year, Larry Jones. He came to LSU as a 17-year-old in 1951 when Harry Truman was president. Now with Barack Obama as president of the United States, 62 years later, Larry Jones is still a prominent member of the LSU community. We'll talk with Coach Larry Jones. And Tom Folsom, a fascinating biography about the Hollywood madman, bad boy, whatever you want to call him, Dennis Hopper, who made his big break right here in Louisiana with Easy Rider. All this, now the news on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, and we're joined by Tara McGinnis. She is Executive Director for the Center for American Progress Action, and she is across the country surveying gun violence. And in Louisiana, we have a rate that compares with the worst states in America. Good morning to you, Tara McGinnis.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Well, how does Louisiana compare with the rest of the country in homicides by gun?
Well, we are releasing a new report that shows Louisiana has the worst level of gun violence in the country. What the report basically shows is when it comes to women and children in particular getting murdered with guns, as well as police officers, Louisiana is in the top three in all of these measures.
Well, Louisiana had, according to your survey in 2010, the worst gun murder rate in the nation, 9.5 murders per 100,000 people, more than 2.5 times higher than the national average, which is 3.6 murders per 100,000 people. Now, Louisiana is way ahead of the curve on this in a most dubious and unenviable category. Has anything changed since 2010?
The trend looks very similar. We base our data on an ongoing database, but the trend looks up through 2012 that guns are taking a life of a Louisianan every 10 hours. And we put these statistics out there very, we're talking about numbers here, but we do this in order to really bring issue to the lives that are at stake. And we're hoping by putting out an analysis like this, this analysis in particular shows that there is there's correlation between the states that have weak gun laws and the states that have high gun violence.
Tara McGinnis is with us. She, as stated, is Executive Director for the Center for American Progress Action. This is a think tank out of Washington, right?
That's right.
And you're from New York State?
That's right.
And a graduate of the University of Pennsylvania from the fighting city of Philadelphia. Now, more than one person is murdered with a gun in Louisiana every day. Your numbers a few moments ago indicate that, what, it's actually one every 10 hours?
Yeah, that's correct.
All right. Well, that'd be 2.5 people almost every day. And from 2001 through 2010, 4,519 people were murdered by guns in our state. That's more than 1,000 more than all U.S. combat deaths during the Iraq War. So what are you advocating as a way to address this alarming number?
We are advocating for the idea of making it harder for criminals and stalkers and domestic abusers, the seriously mentally ill, to get guns easily by requiring a background check on every gun sale. We think this is one straightforward step in allowing law enforcement officials to do their jobs. And we produce reports like this to show the scope of the number of people that are being impacted.
In 2010, 67 children in Louisiana were murdered with guns. All these numbers rank us right at the top of this category in the United States, but yet in Louisiana, as in many other southern states in particular, we love our guns, we treasure the Second Amendment. It's a culture that's unlikely to change anytime soon. So when you're being realistic along these lines and with this backdrop, what really can be done as far as changing not only attitudes, but changing behavior?
I think there's a real change in the conversation across the country and, frankly, in Washington, D.C., about not changing any elements of our American culture, our tradition of sport shooting, but really there's been a lot of change in the technology of these weapons. We're talking about types of weapons that are used in Iraq and Afghanistan, and that there are simple measures that can be put in place, including making it, right now, background checks should be done so that we don't have people who the police know to be criminal offenders or with a history of stalker. There's some very straightforward pieces that would allow, you know, law enforcement officials to really do their jobs.
Well, Tara McGinnis, where are the hotspots in Louisiana? What are the most dangerous places in our state?
The way we actually did this data didn't aggregate by region. We wanted to make sure that you're talking about per 100,000 citizens. So our data doesn't really pinpoint specific hotspots. It sort of says compare state by state for every 100,000 people. How is Louisiana doing? And in fact, 2010, Louisiana had basically double the rate of many other states for every 100,000 people.
Well, there are those who would say that in Louisiana, there are places where it is dangerous, and there are other places where it's as safe as it is anywhere in the United States. It's just a matter of where you are, where you live, and how you conduct your life. And that if you don't go around looking for trouble, or you're not in a place where a lot of trouble is happening around you, you're not really in any significant danger in Baton Rouge or New Orleans, two of the top murder cities in the United States, that most of the activity is criminal on criminal. What do you say to them, to people who say, look, this isn't my problem?
Well, I think, something that this data shows is that even in very quiet places and places across the country where people don't think this happens in their neighborhood, there's a much higher rate of women and children and law enforcement officials being hurt by bullets. I grew up in a small town. I never thought that I would find myself at the other end of a gun, and I have. I think this is something that we look around at our, sisters and brothers and parents and say, is there anything else we could do to make our community safer? Small changes in the way that we address the background system, check system, or even, addressing, making sure that weapons of war are not so easily accessible by criminals and by just awash in the streets. And I think looking at the incidents of the past year, a lot of Americans look around and say, can't we do something a little better?
You say you've been a victim. What
Yes.
happened to you?
When I was a kid in high school, I was in a car and had a gun pointed at the car. It was definitely frightening. I think anyone who has ever had this encounter of being scared for their loved ones, that's a very, very mild form. For families who have loved ones who are injured or lose their lives, it changes the lives of people in their community forever.
Are you asking people to contact lawmakers? Are you attempting to persuade people who might be on the fence on some
Absolutely.
Of these gun issues?
Yeah. Right now and in all over April, senators and congressmen in particular, the action is in the U.S. Senate right now. Both of Louisiana's senators, Senator Landrieu and Senator Vitter, have an opportunity coming up in April to make a difference in these laws. And I hope that Senator Landrieu and Senator Vitter and senators across the country will respond to the outpouring. There's a new survey just here of Louisiana that shows that 85% of Louisianans want every gun buyer to pass a criminal background check. That seems very straightforward. It seems like Democrats and Republicans alike could agree on this, and we have a new moment to mm-hmm. take this opportunity up in April in the U.S. Senate.
During your visit to our fair state and in some of the most deadly cities in America, do you feel safe?
That's a good question. I feel safe, but I also think there's many things we can do to make things safer in the U.S. And, in the greatest country in the world, I think we should be being as creative and thoughtful as possible about protecting our families and children.
So when you walk the streets of Baton Rouge, do you carry a weapon?
I don't carry a weapon, but frankly, I haven't been walking the streets of Baton Rouge. I'm rushing around to tell as many people about this report. I've been in a couple of taxi cabs this morning.
Well, you have to get out of cars and get to front entrances. That's walking.
It's true.
So some people, it's not a flippant remark, but some people do feel unsafe being on the streets at any time. And some say it's because we hear so many stories about gun violence, and there is more of it here than in other places, but for the most part, people are not affected by this kind of violence. And when it doesn't happen in, quote, my neighborhood,
right?
Many people say, look, it's somebody else's issue and that they can deal with it, but if I want to have as many guns and what kind of guns I have, it's my business. It's not the business of the U.S. government.
You know, I think that's a common sentiment that many people have. Although I'll say I think many people watched what happened in Connecticut and saw children the age of their children on television and had just dropped their kids off at school or picking them up and thought, you know, I think the people of Connecticut thought this was a quiet community where nothing like this could happen either. And I think that moment gave the nation pause about, really, are we doing everything we possibly can to protect our children? And I would argue that the answer is no, and that although this may not be happening in your community, is it okay if it's happening in any community in the country?
Well, with 9.5 murders per 100,000 people in Louisiana each year, that would mean that if Tiger Stadium on a Saturday night is reflective of the population at large, that would mean that in a given year that 9.5% of the people in the stadium, or maybe 9 or 10 people in the stadium, would be dead by guns by the end of the year.
That's correct.
We thank you, Tara McGinnis, for joining us today, Executive Director for the Center for American Progress Action.
Thank you so much for taking the time.
This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. And our guest at this time is Larry Jones, a man who has served LSU in ways few people have as far as the diversity of his positions at the university, from student and athlete to coach and athletic director to fundraiser. The man's raised more than $35 million for the Old War School working at Louisiana State University. And by virtue of his long service and success, Larry Jones, the pride of Little Rock Central High School, is this year's Alumnus of the Year and will be honored along with others on April 12th, a few days from now, as LSU salutes one of its great graduates. Good morning, Larry Jones.
Good morning, Jim.
How are you, Coach?
Doing pretty good.
I know the last few months have been a challenge for you.
Well, they have. I've been in and out of hospitals in Baton Rouge and Methodist Hospital with esophagus cancer and blood infection. Just can't seem to get it all done and all well and back to normal, but I'm hanging in there.
Well, you're a tough guy, but I understand you really haven't had a meal in 9 months.
That's right. I haven't had anything to eat since July the 19th last summer, except when I cheated one time on Thanksgiving Day at home. And I just couldn't stand it.
So you had a little bit of regular food.
I cheated and I got sick.
Well, 9 months of being fed through tubes is no fun. And you can hear from his voice, this guy is still a vibrant person. He has friends all over the United States, and he's been a great ambassador for Louisiana State University. As I said, you grew up in Little Rock.
Right. I went to... in those days, it was just a Little Rock High School. It wasn't even called Central. Later on, when they added some high schools, it became Central. But Little Rock High School was the largest high school, I think, in the South. And, you know, I had over 700, 800 students graduate in my graduating class in 1951.
And you came to LSU. Do you recall your first trip to the Old War School?
Yes. In fact, it was to the we came to LSU and went to the LSU-Tulane game in New Orleans. And that was the game where the Tulane students kidnapped Mike the Tiger outside of, I think, a restaurant in La Place. Maybe a little further in, closer to New Orleans, but they unhooked him. The students taking Mike to the game went in to get some refreshments, and they came out, and Mike was gone. And they had a big sign up around the stadium that says, "We've got Mike." So they had him. They sure did. But I think we got him back okay.
How did the LSU people get Mike back?
I don't remember. I think they found him, and I'm sure the Tulane students weren't smart enough to figure out how to take care of him.
Well, you were at LSU starting in 1951, and The coach was Gaynell Tinsley at that time, and then, of course, after you graduated, where you were a player too, linebacker, correct, 1954 star of the team, Larry Jones?
No, I wasn't star of the team. I was on the team and fortunately was able to start, played the center and linebacker, and played with Sid Fournette, Gary Dildy, Al Doggett, Jerry Marchand. There were some great players. And I really enjoyed my time, you know, at LSU and playing.
And in those days, players played both offense and defense.
Right, and it was a slower game.
But then you went into coaching, and you spent some time with Paul Dietzel, and you were there in 1958 when LSU won it all.
Right. First, I was in 1955, I was a graduate assistant with Coach Dietzel. And then when I came back out of the Air Force in 58 in August, he put me on and gave me full duties. And that was the year of the national championship and the GOAT team, the white team, the Chinese Bandits, and the start of a 19-game winning streak and the national championship.
You and Coach Dietzel are the only ones alive as far as the coaching staff from
1958. Right, that's right. And Coach Dietzel, in about a year and a half, is going to be 90 years old, and he looks great. He looks better than I do.
Well, you'll turn 80 on December 18th, and it's been quite a ride for Larry Jones, and much of it spent at his alma mater, Louisiana State University. That 1958 team, of which you were an assistant coach, it was a team that came off a 5-5 season the year before and then wins the national title. I imagine the Baton Rouge was crazy about the Tigers at that time.
Well, they went wild. It really was. It was one of the most exciting times, I think, in LSU football history. It kind of slipped up on them, you know, when we won four or five games there real early, and people kind of got the feeling, hey, we got something here. And, of course, we had three Baton Rouge High guys in the backfield, Warren Rabb at quarterback and Billy Cannon and Johnny Robinson at halfback, and Red Broadnax was the blocking back for those guys at fullback. And it was it was an exciting time, but to have Billy Cannon, you know, and Johnny and Warren, all three from Baton Rouge, I think proved a point to a lot of us at how good Baton Rouge high school area football was. And there were several other players, you know, from Baton Rouge that really contributed heavily.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them, of course, was on the Bandit team, Gus Kinchin, you know, was a fine player. And Don Norwood was on the GO team. Those are two guys, one from, they're from Baton Rouge High.
Yeah.
And those were all fine football players.
That's 55 years ago, as hard as it is for Larry Jones to believe, when he was coaching the Tigers in. Larry was a man of 24. And LSU wins the national championship. Larry goes on to a successful assistant coaching career in many places, and ultimately is the head coach at Florida State University. You had two good seasons and one not-so-good season. What do you recall about being one of the predecessors to Bobby Bowden at Tallahassee?
Well, the first thing I remember was that, you know, we were fortunate enough to go to the first Fiesta Bowl against Arizona State, who had Danny White at quarterback. And had been a real good defensive team up until that point. But they outscored us, I think, about 42-35. I remember that game. I remember that Florida State was in a tough times as far as financially, really had just been a girl school, a woman's teachers university. and it was really struggling, you know, to make ends meet and to have a football program, and our facilities were way subpar, and it made it very difficult to recruit, and especially when you have an in-state rival as strong and powerful throughout the state as the University of Florida was. So it was a difficult time, and our recruiting really slipped because of the lack of facilities and financial support.
You had people like Bill Parcells, Mack Brown, Lou Holtz. They were your assistant coaches, weren't they?
Yes. I had Lou Holtz as my secondary coach when I was at South Carolina, the defensive coordinator. And I had Mack Brown and Bill Parcells as assistants at Florida State, and also had Steve Sloan as my offensive coordinator at FSU. And all these guys were great coaches. I also had Jim Donnan, who later on became head coach at Georgia. A lot of these guys are in halls of fame, and they were great coaches. And I remember Bill Parcells coaching the linebackers at FSU, and when they didn't do real well, he'd call them, "You girls aren't doing very well today."
Larry Jones, the alumnus of the year for Louisiana State University. Twice you've been the interim athletic director at LSU. Those were interesting times, weren't they?
Yes, they were. Those were really, those were times that followed the addition of the women's sports to the athletic program. When I came back to LSU in 1979 as the associate athletic director and the NCAA compliance officer, it was a time that things were changing fast. We were adding women's sports. Who thought at that time that we would have a training table that was co-ed and training rooms and equipment rooms and all these things that you had to have, you had to expand because of the women. And it was a great time. It really was. It was an exciting time. And I remember women's basketball with Jackie Walker.
Yeah.
One of the greatest players ever play any sport at LSU. What a star she was. And I remember Sandra Smith in gymnastics. And these were great times. Dee Dee Bro, still there, coaching, right. Bless her heart. Dee Dee's been there forever and is a great coach and a great person. Great times. And I remember being interim AD when things were in a state of flux and nobody knew really what was going on and what direction LSU was going to go. And I enjoyed being the interim AD and learning more about the SEC, going to SEC AD meetings and official meetings, things like that.
Right.
And it was also interesting to be the NCAA compliance officer, to work and have the challenges of working with all the coaches and some of them's questions and problems, and working with Dale Brown. You know, how exciting. Every day with Dale was an excitement, just the way Dale did things.
Right.
And the exciting time with the great teams that Dale had at that time.
Well, speaking of Dale Brown, as we know, Dale Brown's had a long-running feud with Bobby Knight. Larry Jones, I don't know of anybody who doesn't like this man, and one of his closest friends is none other than Bob Knight.
Well, that's right. Bob and I were real good friends, and we talked quite often, just like I talk with Lou Holtz. Bob was at West Point, a young head coach, and his one of his players was Mike Krzyzewski, played at Army. And those were exciting times. I remember playing noontime basketball with Bobby Knight and Bill Battle. Bill Battle now is the AD at Alabama, and I talked with Bill just two or three days ago on how excited I was that Bill was named AD at Alabama. So meeting people and becoming friends with Bill Battle and Bobby Knight when they were young and when they were on their way up. And you could tell that those were guys that were going to be successful.
Well, you're a guy who does it the old school way. You still send handwritten notes to people, don't you?
Right. In fact, I was sitting here right now just finishing a letter to one of our donors that sends $5,000 a year. And I was just writing a bunch of them.
Well, Larry Jones has raised $35 million since 1989 for LSU. Appropriately, he is the alumnus of the year. A fine man, a great warrior who's battled cancer and beaten it down and has survived esophageal cancer. And on April 12th at the Lott Cook Center, appropriately, Coach Larry Jones will be named Alumnus of the Year by Louisiana State University. 62 years ago, he enrolled at the Old War School. Thank you, Coach.
It's been a pleasure, Jim, and I'm really thankful and appreciative and humble of this award.
Take care, my friend.
Thank you, Jim.
This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Our guest at this time is Tom Folsom. He is the author of Hopper, A Journey into the American Dream. In 2010, as actor Dennis Hopper was dying of cancer, he barricaded himself inside part of his Los Angeles compound and began an ugly divorce battle with his wife, who also lived on the compound. At the battle became a media frenzy, and Hopper's other ex-wives and children joined in a battle for a piece of his valuable estate and art collection. It was a fittingly dramatic end to a life of a troubled genius, a man who starred in such diverse films as Rebel Without a Cause, Easy Rider, Apocalypse Now, and Blue Velvet. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning.
Folsom. This guy, he was an actor who perhaps was underrated. He was such a character, maybe people didn't give him his props for his abilities as a film star.
Well, he was a studio trained actor. His first film being, you know, as you said, Rebel Without a Cause, 1955 for Warner Brothers.
And he starred in that with none other than James Dean. How close were those two?
Well, as Hopper puts it, James Dean was basically his mentor. I mean, you have to take Hopper. He's a kid from Dodge City, Kansas. You know, he's a little starstruck. But he's also, interestingly enough, he's a classically trained Shakespearean actor by the time he's 18. This is because he's living in San Diego, going to high school at Helix High, and he goes to the Old Globe Theater, and there he starts to, you know, learn Shakespeare. So by the time he's showing up under the set of Rebel Without a Cause, you know, he's a really well-trained actor, but then all of a sudden James Dean is doing these things he's never seen before in acting, and it really just shifted the course of Hopper's life and career.
How so?
Well, you know, you see James Dean, if you're looking from Hopper's point of view, you know, he's not just doing these explosive things on film. He's also arguing with his director. He's being a bit of a problem. He's not fitting quite into the studio system, how they like their well-behaved young men and women to act. And so Hopper took a lead from that, and it got him in a lot of trouble because for a while Hopper wasn't exactly James Dean. He was just a struggling actor, and he was very soon blackballed from Hollywood. Sort of for his antics against the studio system.
He was only 19 years old in Rebel Without a Cause, wasn't he?
18 years old.
My goodness. And James Dean wasn't that much older, but he was already a star. And 1955 was the year. That was the year that James Dean died, wasn't it?
It sure was. It was... Well, they do the film Rebel Without a Cause. On the heels of that, Dennis actually goes down to Marfa, Texas, where he's filming the film Giant with James Dean. By the time Rebel Without a Cause comes out later that year, James Dean is dead from having crashed his poor Spider. This was just a few weeks before Rebel opened.
Yeah, and third film was Gunfight at the OK Corral for Dennis Hopper, and he was a busy actor for all of his career. For a man who was considered to be a wild man off the screen, he certainly stayed bankable as an actor.
Well, it's amazing how he's able to survive, you know, as long as he did in Hollywood. I mean, to the point where you have Dennis Hopper, he's showing up in films like Waterworld and Speed in the 1990s.
He was an amazing survivor in the industry. Now, was the wild man reputation, was that something he cultivated? Did he enjoy that?
Well, I think so. I mean, it was definitely something that he cultivated. Dennis was very much conscious of his own myth, and he was also a very good storyteller, and he's a very good actor. And so Dennis really, he played up, you know, his bad boy image, and he also lived it as well. You know, this is sort of the spirit that was behind Easy Rider. I mean, right before, you know, that comes on screen, and you see Dennis Hopper, you know, blazing through America on his chopper. I mean, he'd really alienated the Hollywood system. He was on his way down. He was sort of doing these Roger Corman B motorcycle movies, and all of a sudden, he sort of changes the entire game with Easy Rider, which is this explosive hit.
Easy Rider, some of which was filmed right here in Louisiana, that was a breakthrough film for a few people, including Jack Nicholson. How much of an impact did that film have on Hopper?
Well, it made him an icon. I mean, it got him onto the cover of Life magazine, the nation's biggest magazine at the time. You know, I think what it also did is it sort of put Hopper at the forefront of this counterculture revolution in Hollywood. And so what does Hopper do with this chance? Well, any studio is going to give Dennis Hopper money to make the next Dennis Hopper film. This is because they're hoping that for, say, $300,000, which is what was spent on Easy Rider, they'd get something like $40 million in return, which is just what happened with Easy Rider. So what he does is he makes this film. It's an art film. It's sort of a turn on the classic Western, and it's called The Last Movie. And this is a film that Dennis makes in Peru, of all places. He basically builds a Wild West set on a mountaintop in Peru, and from there he starts to shoot his own strange version of the American dream.
Tom Folsom's Hopper is an electric and rollicking tour de force profile of Hollywood's great outlaw chameleon. That from Douglas Brinkley. Douglas Brinkley says, all the wild-eyed stories and high-octane pathos in these pages makes me miss the edgy grand artist Hopper anew, a knockout book. Now, Dennis Hopper, despite being a character who used drugs and got in trouble and had several wives, he was able to endorse products. People wanted him, like Nike and Gap and Ford. How did that happen?
Well, I think if you survive long enough, what becomes counterculture turns mainstream. And I think Dennis found himself in the position of being able to capitalize on his strange brand of rebelness.
And he was involved with some of the most beautiful women in the world.
That's true. This is including Michelle Phillips of the Mamas and Papas, to which he had an 8-day marriage with.
Yeah, he was married, 5 times, right?
5 times.
5 times, including to Catherine Lanassa, who grew up here in Baton Rouge.
Absolutely.
Was that a bitter breakup when those two parted?
Well, I think they had a reconciliation. So I think that they, you know, they had a son together, Henry Hopper, as well. So, you know, what I thought was interesting is basically at Dennis's funeral, he had three of his 5 ex-wives actually, you know, getting up there and speaking about Dennis.
He died with prostate cancer, didn't he?
That's right. And this is, it's almost a surprising end for someone who, you know, as I'm writing the book, it seems like he should have been dead at the end of every chapter.
Right. Well,
with his wild, you know, with his wild antics.
It was not an easy decline for him, though. He had a tough year or two.
Oh, yes. Definitely.
But did he handle it bravely?
Well, yeah. What I thought was interesting was that, you know, he sort of returned to his roots. Sort of as he was dying, he was watching old cowboy films. And these are the same films that he would watch when he was a young kid growing up in Dodge City, Kansas during the Dust Bowl. You know, these are the singing cowboy films with guys like Roy Rogers. And I thought that that was really interesting, that it was sort of a coming full circle. You know, back to these cowboy films that he loved so much and which really shaped his entire life.
Well, the director of Easy Rider, Dennis Hopper, was, of course, the star of the movie as well. And what a cast, Jack Nicholson, Peter Fonda. Even Phil Spector was in that film, wasn't he?
He was. He's there at the beginning of the film playing the drug dealer, and he's got his orange shades on. But that's Phil Spector right there.
Now, Tom, which movie or movies do you think Dennis will be most remembered for other than Easy Rider?
Well, I think Blue Velvet is a movie that's going to last. For me personally, I don't think anyone's going to ever forget his performance in Apocalypse Now. To me, that's just a thing that you'll never see again on screen. It was just a matter of, time and place and what he brought to that role. But it was such an electric role that, to me, I think that almost stands as his greatest work.
Well, it's an exceptional book from Tom Folsom, Hopper, A Journey into the American Dream. This was a long time in the works, wasn't it?
It was. I'd been working with actually Dennis's literary agent, and they've been trying to get a book going for something like 25 years. And after all these various deals, there was just nothing on the page. So I decided to kind of bravely go forth and storm the gates of Hopperland and write the book myself.
And notable interviews with people like Peter Fonda, David Lynch, Robert Duvall. It is an exceptional book from Tom Folsom. We thank you for joining us, Tom.
Thank you so much.
Take care. And thank you for listening, everybody. Until tomorrow, stay tuned.